Today on Against the Grain, Jewish opposition to Israel, so visible recently through the spectacular actions of groups like Jewish Voice for Peace, is not a recent phenomenon. Historian Marjorie Feld argues that what may seem like unprecedented criticism of Israel by U.S. Jews is in fact part of a long tradition of dissent, which has been repressed by establishment Jewish organizations and frequently erased by historians. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In the face of Israel's devastating assault on Gaza, many American Jews have organized and protested, insisting that the violence not be committed in their name. They've been castigated by other Jews and the Jewish establishment, which, according to Marjorie Feld, is part of a long tradition of U.S. anti-Zionist dissent and pro-Zionist repression, which dates back to the late 19th century. Even before the Holocaust and the establishment of the State of Israel, writes Feld, mainstream Jewish leaders accused Jewish critics of Zionism, of self-hatred, and anti-Semitism. Marjorie Feld is professor of history at Babson College and the author of The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism. Her other books include Nations Divided, American Jews and the Struggle Over Apartheid. Marjorie, I'd like to start by asking you if you could tell us, when were Zionist ideas first discussed in the United States and how were they received by American Jews?
The book begins, the book stretches from the 1880s to the 1980s, and even though the formal global Zionist movement began in the late 1890s, people were talking about, American Jews were talking about Jewish nationalism, even as early as the 1880s. So on American soil, within American borders, American Jews were really debating, talking about what role Jewish nationalism might play in American Jewish communal life. And so even before the global Zionist movement, and certainly before it took roots in the United States, which was really the turn of the 20th century, and especially in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, those debates were happening here. And so what we're seeing is the sort of refrain I keep using is, it is but the latest chapter of over a century of debates about Jewish nationalism, and then the movement that came to be known as Zionism, and role it should play in American Jewish life.
Well, you write, as you chronicle this consistent thread from then, from the late 19th century to the present, of dissent and criticism of Zionism from the 19th century to the present, that this has been a consistent thread that has run through American Jewish politics, American Jewish life. And I wanted to ask you if you could give us a sense of the context in which these debates started to take place, especially in the early 20th century. What were the circumstances that many American Jews found themselves in, and the sort of concerns that animated their political life, obviously bearing in mind that, you know, they were not a monolithic group under monolithic circumstances?
Sure. Well, if we're talking about the early 20th century, we're talking about Euro-Americans, right? American Jews were almost entirely white and hailed from Europe. They were a relatively elite group until Eastern European Jews, from whom many of us descend, including my own family. So the Reform Jews of the early anti-Jewish nationalism movement that I write about in the early chapter, those are elite Americans concerned about losing their elite status. And to fully understand the context, we really need to talk about American exclusion, xenophobia, Jim Crow, Asian exclusion. It was a very racist time, and there were pogroms going on, virulent anti-Semitism in Europe, from which a lot of their families had fled or left because of. And so these are American Jews who are concerned that nationalism will make them appear less loyal to the United States in a time when the loyalty of a lot of immigrants is being questioned. So their anti-nationalism is sort of the logical product of their own desire for safety and security, their desire to integrate into the white mainstream, even the white elites on American soil. Really, it emerges in that context, and it's really central to the Reform Movement, which is a denomination in American Judaism. At the time, it was the most liberal denomination. It's really central to the story of that movement's early anti-nationalism and then anti-Zionism.
Well, tell us more about those politics and the sort of concerns that that group of more privileged Jews had about how Zionism would affect their place in American society.
Well, this is a time when, you know, there wasn't yet a really full understanding that Zionism could coexist with loyal American patriotism or nationalism. And certainly in Europe, around the world, accusations of dual loyalties, you know, that Jews constitute a state within a state, they're not loyal to their own government in their nation where they live, that they're loyal to some higher government. I mean, these are sort of the anti-Semitic fantasies and accusations that motivate terrors across the world. So in the United States, when Reform, relatively elite American Jews are considering nationalism that emerges sort of out of the liturgy of Judaism, they want to be true to a Jewishness, a Jewish identity that will keep them safe from accusations of anti-Semitism and dual loyalties. So they see loyalty to another nation, Palestine, that then becomes Israel, as making them more vulnerable to those accusations. And so their anti-nationalism is about safety and security. It's about a sense of Jewishness as just a religion, not necessarily a peoplehood. And the people who migrate toward the anti-nationalism and the Reform Movement, I think, talk about it in that way. What I try to bring out is the book is that, you know, that's the anti-nationalism and then anti-Zionism of the early 20th century. But a lot of those Reform Jews end up articulating other issues that they have with nationalism and then Zionism, that they really come to see, for instance, Palestinian refugees as central to their rejection of Zionism. They come to see the stifling of conversations about Israel and Zionism as central to their rejection of Zionism. So it may, their anti-Jewish nationalism and their anti-Zionism begins with a real desire for safety and security, a fear of accusations of dual loyalties, but I think it expands in ways that may ring familiar to readers today.
You mentioned that, of course, waves of immigrants came from Europe, Jewish immigrants, from very different class backgrounds, and they, many of them, were deeply immersed in politics in the countries that they came from or fled from, and many of them were connected to the Jewish left, the Yiddish-speaking left in Europe. Can you describe some of the divisions and groupings of Jewish politics in Europe that then came with immigrants to the United States?
Well, I can do my best. There are wonderful scholars of the European Jewish left, of the European left. What I try to talk about in the book are those who emerged out of the Bund and other movements in Europe that were strongly anti-nationalist. These were radical movements that worked toward justice for Jews and for all people in their nation of origin. It was maybe to our very, I want to say modern or postmodern sensibilities, both Jewish and universalist, that may sound to us a little foreign or a little conflicted or something like this, but they really were emphasizing those individuals and organizations that were not supportive of Jewish nationalism and Zionism, insisted that working for justice here and now where we were was the top priority. And some of them bring those traditions with them to the United States. And into the 40s and 50s, there are radicals, American-born descendants of the left in Europe, and some, you know, come direct from Europe, who reject Zionism along those lines. They want to fight for justice in the countries where they locate themselves. They worry about resources that are going to flow out of the United States and into Palestine and then Israel, and really sort of diminish Jewish life in the United States and even elsewhere in the diaspora, as they, the word that is used for Jewish life outside of Palestine and then Israel. So they have multiple concerns. Some of it comes from their radical politics, and some of it comes from sort of on the ground observations about what's happening in the United States with the fervent dedication to the growth of Palestine and then Israel.
This is not the focus of your book, but I wondered if you could at least characterize for us or give us a sense of the Zionist politics that were also on offer at the time. I think for a lot of people, they might assume now, looking at the history of Zionism, that it was simply a right-wing, in our sense, kind of nationalist movement. But there were those who identified as left who also saw themselves as Zionist. Can you explain that?
Sure. The second chapter of the book really begins with William Zuckerman, who is on the left. And in the 30s and early 40s, he's in Europe. He does travel to Palestine. And he is a socialist Zionist, a labor Zionist, among many in the world, including some in the United States. These were people who had held on to an image of a Jewish state as a place where what they would call then Arabs and Jews could live together in a sort of, like a utopian socialist communal community. They were really hoping that working together in the fields, making the desert bloom, as some of these individuals talked about, that working side by side, they would reach a sort of utopia where labor would set them all free, right? There would be no discrimination. There would be equal participation. There would be democracy for Arab and Jewish peoples in this land. And even still today, there are people who consider themselves liberal Zionists. Some count themselves as drawing from the heritage of socialist or labor Zionists, who think about Israel as having the potential for now we would say Palestinians and Jewish Israelis to live side by side and to work side by side, and in that way create a more just society. So I think especially in the 20s and 30s, there was a vibrant socialist and labor Zionist community in the United States that were watching Israel carefully to see just how things developed, who was included in labor unions, how equally labor was distributed and opportunities were distributed and resources were distributed. And then, I'm sure we'll talk about this, then came the Nakba and the gradual dispossession and oppression of Palestinian people that really put the lie to this idea that Israel was going to emerge as a communal living arrangement, as a more just society.
Marjorie Feld is my guest. She's professor of history at Babson College, and we're discussing The Threshold of Dissent, a history of Jewish American critics of Zionism. Marjorie, you argue in your book that there's a long history of American Jewish criticism of Zionism and also of the repression of that criticism. Would you say that that repression dates from the establishment of the State of Israel, or does it precede it in any way in the United States?
Definitely precedes it. There are individuals in the United States, Jewish journalists, a smattering of individuals here and there, who are wary of the direction that Israel, Palestine, and then Israel is taking, who are concerned that Palestinians are not being fully included in the emerging nation state, who are concerned about which kinds of investment Israel is making and taking, and concerns too, very serious concerns about the priorities of American Jewish life and the ways in which the sort of, to use William Zuckerman's term, he's somebody I write about as a non, and then I think it's fair to call him an anti-Zionist in the 40s and 50s. He would call it the land grabbing that happens in Palestine and then Israel. He became very disheartened with this and started publishing criticism of Israel, and really what amounts, if you read it carefully, to hope for Palestine and then Israel to take a different direction in the 40s and 50s. And his criticism is, they really try to erase it. And when I say they, it's not just American Jewish communal leaders, but also those are in cooperation with Israeli diplomats and individuals in the Israel Foreign Office who are trying to squash that criticism. So this policing of dissent and marginalization of dissent date back much further than, say, 1973, which a lot of people use as the date because that was the founding of a liberal organization called Breira, which criticized Israel's treatment of Palestinians. So it does date back further, and the stakes were very high, even at the time that Zuckerman was writing in the 1940s and 50s.
How did the Holocaust and then the importance of Israel as a Cold War ally of the United States strengthen this repression, the repression of Jewish anti-Zionism in the United States?
It's impossible to overstate that impact. It's a great question for that reason. The devastation of the Holocaust, the trauma that lived in American Jewry, can't be understated. It was profound, deeply affecting, and of course horribly tragic. So to think about American Jewish disunity, right, as dangerous, this was very common in the 1940s, and then after knowledge of the Holocaust sort of spread across the world. The sense was that any disunity on the part of American Jews could lend itself to the buildup of another genocidal attack, that it could lead to and contribute to anti-Semitism. These were very real fears. And then, you know, these are American Jews, largely white, as I mentioned earlier. In the 50s and 60s, once the Holocaust sort of vanquishes, largely but not entirely vanquishes, anti-Semitism and its legitimacy, these are individuals that are achieving quite a lot of success. You're moving into suburbs and achieving socioeconomic mobility, for certain achieving whiteness, as many American Jews, Euro-American Jews did. So the Cold War alliance with Israel is... it sort of, in many ways, sort of presents an opportunity, this is how I talk about it in the book, for a move into more powerful positions for American Jews who have been advocating for Israel and who see Israel as the most profound security against an anti-Semitic attack of any scale. Worst of all, right, is the nightmare of the potential for yet another attempt at genocide. So unity on Israel, allegiance to every step that Israel makes, becomes in many ways the litmus test for American Jewish communal life, and the lowering of the threshold dissent has to be put in that context. It's really inextricable from it.
And yet you also argue that this concern about Jewish safety in the face of anti-Semitism in the wake of the Holocaust was not answered for many people by the establishment of the State of Israel. In other words, that for many American Jews, they did not assume that the State of Israel made them safer. Can you talk about that kind of politics in mid-century, how people saw their security in the United States as it related or didn't to the establishment of a Jewish state?
The people I'm interested in presenting a history of American Jewish critics are the critics themselves, and I try to flesh out their full context. Very important to me in telling the story, and even in talking to you today, is to emphasize that the individuals who criticized American Zionism didn't care less about American Jewish life, about Jewish life in general. These are individuals who had a deep affinity for it. They felt a strong, in some cases, even responsibility toward it. And in criticizing Israel, they were, to their minds, and, you know, obviously people should read the book and see how persuasive I am in presenting it this way, but they were acting out what they felt, acting in the best of security concerns for American Jewish life, for that to flourish. So you have American Jews who are looking at what's happening in Palestine and then Israel. And over the course of the century that I study in the book, there are many occasions where a journalist will look at American Jewish life and say, ah, here is this division, a never before seen division in American Jewish life over Israel and whether or not it keeps Jews safe. It happened in the 50s. It happened, of course, after 67. And those who criticize often are doing it in that vein in order to think about American Jews as working toward, and themselves as working toward, greater Jewish safety.
It's also striking that some of the ways that Jews have, anti-Zionist Jews today, have been shamed for their dissent actually has, quite a lot of resonance with the past and deeper roots. That is, by labeling people self-hating Jews or actually actively anti-Semitic themselves. Can you talk about those traditions, if we could put it that way, dating back in the earlier 20th century?
Sure, for sure. I refer to it as an old playbook. I think it's a very old playbook that many would locate its origins perhaps in the publication of the Anti-Defamation League's book, The New Anti-Semitism, which was published in the early 1970s. I think there's a tradition of American Jews looking to the left, the political left, that is, anti-colonialist movements, civil rights, liberation movements, and finding there this ghost of anti-Semitism's past, right? In all criticism of Israel, it's delegitimized by virtue of being seen as anti-Semitic. It's really a way to put the lid on it, to erase it, to say that it doesn't hold any water, that it can only be seen as attacking Jews. But to do that is to ignore this long history of Jewish intra-communal dissent from American Zionism and unqualified American Zionism. And in order to delegitimize Jewish critics of unqualified American Zionism, a lot of Jewish communal leaders have relied on that old playbook of calling them anti-Semitic themselves or self-hating or pathologizing their criticism of Israel instead of seeing it as part of this vibrant history of debating, which is obviously quite vibrant in American Jewish and other Jewish communal life. Centuries of Jewish debating over Jewish teachings, over interactions with the non-Jewish world. Some would see it in that vein rather than labeling it anti-Semitic or self-hating. But there is this long, unfortunate, tragic tradition of trying to erase it by calling those who embrace it anti-Semitic. And just to go back to a second to the political left, I think in the 60s and 70s especially, there were whole generations of American Jews who were never given any access to the history of Palestine, Palestinians, the Nakba, occupation. They didn't grow up understanding it fully. And when they were on the left and joined civil rights movements or reading about Black Power movements and encountered criticism of Israel, many of them did this for the first time. And the American Jewish world, again, so cautious with regard to any divisions on Israel or on anything out of concern for Jewish safety. When the American Jewish world issued ultimatums, essentially, that American Jews had to choose between their Jewishness or these anti-colonialist critiques of Israel, many felt that they really had to choose Jewishness. And those who felt they wanted to choose these sort of broader critiques of colonialism across the world, including in Israel, left the Jewish world behind. So I guess I would say that the cost to the low threshold dissent is very, very high. I think the American Jewish world has lost a lot of families and individuals who learned from these broader lessons, but were told that they couldn't remain in the American Jewish community and still hold on to these ideas.
Well, let's stay with the period you're just describing, because, of course, many Jewish organizations in mid-century were supportive of the struggles that we think of as the left in the United States, certainly the struggle for civil rights for African Americans. And then, of course, in the same period, you have this, as you alluded to, a wave of anti-colonial movements that swept the world and inspired many people in the United States, including people on the left. How would you characterize the relationship that American Jews and establishment organizations had to civil rights in the 1960s and 70s, especially, well, before and after the Israeli seizure of additional Palestinian lands post-1967?
There has been terrific scholarship about the so-called Black Jewish Alliance. Mark Dollinger's book is terrific, and he's in San Francisco. And I think at the same time, there has been not a lot written or studied with regard to Israel and Palestine and its role in that relationship. I think that a lot of civil rights leaders and leaders in other anti-colonialist movements were learning and teaching lessons about Israel that were essential, right? Exposing people to these histories for the first time, because not a lot of this information came into the United States or was taught to most Americans. And I think it really complicated the relationships of American Jewish mainstream organizations to civil rights organizations. It was one of the reasons, one of many complicated reasons for the breakdown of the so-called Black Jewish Alliance. In the 70s, you know, I talked about this in my book on apartheid as well. You have Black leaders coming together in the face of just tremendous tragedy. So many leaders assassinated, some by the U.S. government, as is now known. And they're coming together and talking about their gratitude toward American Jews for their contributions to civil rights and to Black freedom, at the same time as they feel a certain paternalism has been embedded in that relationship for a long time. And part of what some of these leaders talk about is sort of breaking free from that paternalism is meeting with the Palestinian groups and embracing Palestinian freedom and the Palestinian cause. So I think that it's, you pinpoint it, and it's important because it was a really fraught flashpoint between mainstream American Jewish groups and civil rights and other groups that were working for the liberation of people of color. And I'll also just say quickly that I think a lot of the organizations that I chronicle in this book, the ones that take a dissenting position on American Zionism, those are the very organizations that are forming, however tenuous, alliances with Black groups in the very difficult 1980s, even into the 1990s. And that's not incidental. It's because they were open to listening to critiques of Israel that I think that explains in part their ability to form coalitions with people of color.
And how would you say that in that period, those dissenting Jews and Jewish groups were kept in line or try to be pushed into line by what you describe as a consensus that is manufactured over not criticizing Israel?
Well, in the 50s and 60s, William Zuckerman had Israeli diplomats and American Jewish mainstream leaders working concertedly to deny him opportunities. He lost several journalistic jobs. He lost funding. American Jewish life, you know, in the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 decades, we have umbrella. There are umbrella organizations in most towns that decide where the funds will be dedicated to what organizations. And in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, organizations that were really striving to criticize Israel, create coalitions, and maybe not Israel at the center of their work, but, you know, sort of liberal work, coalition work was at the center of their work for LGBTQ rights, environmentalism, and now I'm talking about New Jewish Agenda in the 80s. These organizations, in some cases, lost funding from these umbrella Jewish groups. They were subjects of, you know, negative publicity. I mean, I'm saying this in some ways flippantly and casually, but I know well some of these individuals who were in these organizations. It affected their lives profoundly. It was something from which they really had to recover. The negative publicity that they received, the threats, the equations of them, you know, they were equated, their ideas were equated with anti-Semitism and self-hatred and Hitlerism. It's been very difficult and damaging to try to carve out the space to articulate dissent because of this very strong manufactured consensus, which was grounded in a need for safety and which came to promote and protect Jews' relatively elite and powerful status, some Jews' relatively elite and powerful status. And I think we're seeing now the sort of cracks in the foundation of that manufactured consensus.
Marjorie Feld is my guest. She's professor of history at Babson College and the author of The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Marjorie, you've written elsewhere about the complexity of American Jewish opposition to apartheid South Africa. Obviously a pariah state that counted few allies, but those allies included the United States and Israel. In a nutshell, how would you characterize those divisions as they came to the fore amongst American Jews in a period when campus movements swept through the U.S. in many ways, in, you know, reminiscent of the encampments that we've seen around Palestine?
So I wrote that book in the 2010s, and as it went to press, sadly, Nelson Mandela died, and there was a whole spate of, it's felt shocking at the time, a whole spate of Jewish journalistic wonderings about whether or not Mandela was quote-unquote good for the Jews. It seemed shocking to me, and yet given what I had just written, it shouldn't have been. It really shouldn't have been. And all of that is to say that Mandela was somebody who likened the struggle of Black South Africans against apartheid to Palestinians working for freedom, struggling for freedom in Israel and throughout the Palestinian diaspora. I mean, there's sort of a, I suppose, oversimplified way to think about the legacies of the Holocaust on Jews around the world. For some, it was Jewish survival has to come by any means that are at our disposal, right? We have to fight in all ways and in any way to secure Jewish safety. And then there's this other approach, which is that because of what happened to Jews in the Holocaust of World War II, we have a special responsibility to respect the rights of all people. And I think in the 70s and 80s, as Israel was sort of more and more marginalized on the world stage and became an ally with apartheid South Africa, a lot of American Jews, even self-identified liberal American Jews, thought that this alliance with apartheid South Africa was what Israel had to do to survive. To talk to American Jews I know and to hear the voices of American Jews who were in their 50s and 60s now is to know that that alienated a tremendous number of American Jews who really wanted no affiliation or association with American Jewish life because they saw American Jewry very quiet when it came to criticism of apartheid South Africa because of this relationship between Israel and South Africa, because Israel was getting weapons from apartheid South Africa. So whereas there were these encampments in places even like Brandeis, which was founded Jewish but is non-sectarian, and in other places around the country, there were these encampments that were courageous young college students drawing attention to the evils of apartheid, there were a lot of conflicts over whether or not Jewish students should be involved in the anti-apartheid struggle because Israel needed to secure its future, Israel needed to secure its safety, and that alliance between apartheid South Africa and Israel took center stage in many conversations. So thus, when Mandela died, the book was going to press, I started to think and write about the ways in which an unconditional fealty to Israel stood in the way of American Jews' progressive stands and positioning with regard to things like apartheid, and then dating back further, civil rights, Vietnam, feminism. If you trace back American Jewish participation in these movements, Israel played a central role in American Jewish involvement because American Jews felt, quote unquote, forced to choose between fealty to Israel and the broad sort of expansive critiques of these movements that in many cases included critiques of Israel.
We'll return to precisely that question of how the manufactured consensus around Israel and Zionism affected Jews and their relationship to the U.S. left. But I wanted to stay with the 1980s for a moment more. And you mentioned earlier New Jewish Agenda. And I wonder if you could tell us what that organization was and the ways it was repressed in that period.
New Jewish Agenda is founded when Reagan is elected and in the midst of the Lebanon War, again, another time when there's great heralding of these unprecedented divides in American Jewish life. And of course, there are precedents and there continue to be these same headlines over whether American Jews are united or not. New Jewish Agenda was young American Jews. It was an organization that had learned its lesson from the teardown. I mean, there's really no other way to say it, the brutal crushing of dissent that happened with Breira, which was founded in the 70s. New Jewish Agenda did not center Israel and Palestine in its initial platforms, and it was very decentralized. Individual chapters could take on all different kinds of concerns. And if you think about any progressive issue in the 1980s, New Jewish Agenda chapters were doing this work. They were a part of the struggle for disability rights, environmental rights, fighting nuclear power and nuclear weapons, disarmament, feminism, civil rights, working against the war on the social welfare net that we're still living with. You know, all of these things, Latin American, Cold War, militarism, and New Jewish Agenda really tried to provide a counterforce to the American Jewish establishment's relative quiet with regard to the Reagan agenda and the conservative agenda. So this turn to the right that happened in Israel in 77 and the United States with President Reagan's election in 1980, New Jewish Agenda is trying to push back against that. And there are people who say that there are the scholars who've written about New Jewish Agenda in more dedicated ways than I have point to multiple reasons that New Jewish Agenda eventually fell apart. There are so many organizations by the early 90s in American Jewish life. That's certainly part of it. But almost everyone I talk to who was in New Jewish Agenda or whose voices I read about talk about LGBTQ rights and Israel as two really central reasons that the American Jewish mainstream was not open to New Jewish Agenda's platform, to their ideas, and ultimately led to their demise.
Your book, the period of time that you look at, ends in the 1980s, but I wonder if you can lay out for us what do you think are the crucial organizations that have spearheaded the kind of repression of critical perspectives from the Jewish community around Israel. Would you say there's some organizations that play outsized roles, or would you say it's so until, you know, recently, of course, we've seen cracks and fissures, but do you think that part of it has been that there's been such a monolithic repression that has been embedded within so much of Jewish life that people in many ways have until, you know, fairly recently, self-censored themselves without necessarily having any organization sort of looking over their shoulder?
Oh, that's a great question. So whenever I mean, I've done a bunch of teach-ins now for young people, students on campuses since October. And I guess, and this is going to be related to answering your question. I never begin with anything. I always begin with talking about the number of people I knew with numbers on their arms when I was growing up. that is to say Holocaust survivors, right? People who had been in the camps, and there were dozens that I knew who were in my synagogue and my lived among my grandparents. In fact, the last person I knew who was a survivor died last year. And I really think there's a profound sense of that first person experience leaving us and the trauma that is left in its wake, you know, not just having knowing about the Holocaust and what happened, but also losing the living, breathing evidence of that tragedy is profound. And so I think there, for a community that for a century has been talking about Israel as the best security against another Holocaust, yes, I think that self-censoring becomes a part of that intergenerational trauma. I think that you learn that you're not supposed, what you're not supposed to do. And so I would point to complicity, if I can use that word. And it's, you know, it's a complex word, right? Because we're talking about people who are convinced that this is what American Jewish and maybe even global Jewish safety depends on, is unity on Israel. That said, there are certainly organizations that have gone around and not paid much attention to the motivations of those who have criticized Israel, which is to say that, you know, the Anti-Defamation League looms large in this conversation because they were spying on people in the 70s and continue to. Today, I think it's moved even further to the right, and the statements that they're making about anti-Zionism being anti-Semitism are so very damaging. So if you're looking to talk to historicize one organization, I would point to that one, and also point to the trauma that many American Jews live with in their family lives, in their institutional lives, in their affiliated lives. I think that's important too.
Historically, in the United States and in Europe, up until at least the mid or later 20th century, Jews played a key role on the left. And while you're arguing that there have always been Jewish critics of Zionism, you also show how their dissent has been marginalized. And I wonder if you think something you said earlier, that the so-called Zionist consensus, if that ruptured in some ways, that connection between many Jews and the left. This is an argument that Enzo Traverso has made, that in the earlier part of the 20th century, many Jews identified with a kind of universal liberation, and that Jewish liberation was universalized as they saw it, and that there was a kind of conservatism, a moving away, and that Israel was crucial to that.
I think I would have to immerse myself in the scholarship to be able to take issue with it, but I do think that some the voice that I rely on, what so many of us rely on, is James Baldwin, right, with his prophetic discussions of whiteness and blackness, and I try to weave that into a discussion of Jewish safety and security and power and elite status. So I'm not sure, exactly sure how to answer your question. I do think that for the Jews, American Jews that I know and whose voices I've read and listened to, there's no question that being in left coalitions or liberal coalitions, when they heard Israel criticized, that they felt personally threatened. And I think there's a lot of conversation today about danger and peril. And I think we have to be really careful to differentiate that from discomfort. I think a lot of Jews in the 60s, 50s, 60s, and 70s felt profoundly uncomfortable in coalitions that were criticizing Israel when they had never learned enough to know that some of these critiques were grounded in accurate historical facts. So I don't know enough to chronicle journeys from the left in large numbers. I know enough to know that a lot of American Jews left that sense of belonging to liberal and left coalitions behind when they felt uncomfortable with Israel's criticism of Israel.
You've been arguing, and your book argues, that there's this unbroken tradition of American Jewish anti-Zionism that dates back to the late 19th century. That anti-Zionism, that tradition of anti-Zionism, has been stronger at some periods than others, or perhaps more effectively repressed in some periods than others. How would you, I know this is not the focus of your book, but I wonder if you could at least take a stab at assessing the magnitude of American Jewish criticism of Israel right now compared to other eras.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So I say, oh my gosh, because it's so difficult to compare contexts, right? Because in the early 80s with the war in Lebanon, there were outcries and, you know, we're turning a new leaf. This is a new beginning. This is a louder sense of dissent than we've ever heard or seen before. All of these were uttered in the early 80s. But, you know, I had my bat mitzvah in that context in these years, and I knew almost nothing about this. I was, you know, a very dedicated young Zionist, the product of my own upbringing. So now we have social media, right? And so people, young people, are witnessing Grand Central Station takeovers and Statue of Liberty. But the data suggest, and this I can answer with certainty, right? If the Pew data is correct, we have an unprecedented break, generational break, with regard to thinking favorably about Israel and the Israeli government. I mean, I think the newest numbers are from April, which isn't that long ago, and people my age are overwhelmingly supportive of the Israeli government. I'm 53. I'm looking here. Jews age 50 to 64. The majority express a favorable opinion of the Israeli government, 64%. So had you been able to study and document the percentages in the 1980s, I'm certain they would have been much, much far less pronounced. And in part, that's a result of this new kind of communication, the gradual, I don't know, the sort of divorcing of Holocaust consciousness from fealty to Israel, unqualified fealty to Israel, and thinking about only that as protecting Jewish safety. And I think it's just young people hungry for something new. They want access to knowledge about the Nakba. They want more meaningful coalitions. They want American Jewish life to be more vibrant. And so what we're seeing now, and what you're talking about, these protests, I think, is both, it's the product of a century of starving American Jewish educational systems from any kind of access to information about the Nakba, about Palestine, about Israel's shameful history. And it's also the sort of logical evolution, right? Because there's an immense buildup of demand, and these young people are doing these courageous, they're building rather than tearing down. And I think that's laudable. They're trying to create institutions that are meaningful to them. And that's new, right? That there are these institutions, JV, Jewish Voice for Peace, and If Not Now, and others that are building, bringing people in, many of them for the first time, people of all ages coming into Jewish affiliation through these organizations, because they find something there that they have not found, which is, you know, a more complete history and energy toward coalition building.
Let me end, Marjorie Feld, by asking you about the role that American historians have played in obscuring or vanishing the history of the anti-Zionism of American Jews.
There is no question that the narrative of American Jewish life has been one of, you know, it points directly to the victory of Zionism over American Jews, that the triumph of unqualified Zionism is what American Jewish historians, Jewish studies folks, that's what's been chronicled. And in the last, I would say, 20 years, we're starting to see new histories that talk about all voices in American Jewish life, not just those who didn't support Israel, but people who had different ideas of what life in Israel might even be like. I think it's really important to think about the contested priorities of American Jewish life. What should American Jewish life look like? American Jewish historians, and I'm in that community, American historians, historians, scholars have been telling this story of the victory of Zionism in a way that has only reinforced that manufactured consensus. And so I think it's something to celebrate that new voices are being captured, that we're thinking in complex ways about how to universalize it a bit, how different people can articulate what they want out of belonging in a community. I don't think it's a question that's unique just to the Jewish community, but I do think it's a question in the Jewish community that has been made urgent by the devastation that Israel is committing in Gaza right now.
Marjorie Feld, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Marjorie Feld is the author of The Threshold of Dissent, A History of American Jewish Critics of Zionism. She's professor of history at Babson College, and her other books include Nations Divided, American Jews and the Struggle Over Apartheid. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.